The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Taylor and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Danny R.
Hi, everyone. I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic. Just going to minimize you guys for a second. Thank you so much for having me tonight. It is an honor to participate in my sobriety. I was thinking there's definitely a time in my life when nobody required anything of me or asked me to be anywhere ever. And so, you know, it always means a lot when I get asked to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially the last Wednesday before we're going to be in person, which is a whole other ball game being on that podium. It's terrifying. So I'm grateful to be here on Zoom with you all. And so I'll just tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I had a painfully average upbringing. And I say painfully because, I grew up in a little bit in Los Angeles, but then my parents moved me to Simi Valley, for junior high and high school, which if you've never been, oof, I do not recommend it. It's like the middle America of Southern California. I was the only Jewish kid in what felt like the entire city. And, I felt like everyone kind of had the handbook to life besides me. And, you know, I always hear those things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to remember that, like, it wasn't things like that that made me into an alcoholic. I think in retrospect, like, I think everybody seems to feel different at that age and to feel other, and like they can't quite get a grip into the secret of life that everyone else has. But I think the difference for me, especially, and maybe the difference for alcoholics, is like I always wanted what I thought of as like a shortcut. I don't know like where I was going, but I knew I like couldn't get there the same way everyone else was planning to get there. I couldn't, you know, walk through things. I had to like find a way to get around them in some way. And that manifested for me in drugs and alcohol at a really, really young age. And, you know, I'll kind of fast forward just a little bit because I've had a lot of different sobrieties. My sobriety date, and hopefully my last one, is July 7th, 2018. My sponsor is Barbara B. Next week, when we're back in person, I will be taking a cake for 3 years of sobriety, which is the longest I've ever had. And so just going back, you know, I was diagnosed with depression when I was about 15 or 16. And I think that kind of gave me like the agency to, I could blame everything on that, you know, like And for a while it worked. Like I popped a pill, I took a drink, and like I immediately felt motivated to leave the house. I like had this chemical imbalance and like, you don't understand, and this is how I have to deal with it. And, you know, I'm one of four girls and one of four sisters, and my older sister is only 17 months older than I am. Like we're really close in age, but we're completely different. And like, she is, and has always been to this day, just the picture of normalcy. Like my sister is an angel. And she's also just like the simplest, like she's like the pumpkin spice latte girl. She like just wants to like go to Starbucks, and you know, she's just kind of never wanted for anything and was always sort of just happy with life on life's terms. And it just wasn't the same for me. You know, I was just always agitated. And I was in and out of rehabs and detoxes throughout my late teens and into my early 20s. And, you know, I used with people who died. I lived in my car for periods of time. My life was incredibly small. And then, you know, I will say there was this period of time in my mid 20s when I practiced controlled drinking and kind of white knuckled it for several years, you know. And I mention that because if you're new and you think that you don't belong here, because you can remember a time in your history of using and drinking where, you know, you had a handle on it, or you know, you could control your drinking, or maybe you didn't black out the way everybody else blacked out that night. Like, you still belong here. And, you know, for a long time that kept me out of these rooms. I would say that I had these years where like everything was pretty much fine. But the truth is, I was still sort of dying inside. The only replacement at that time was I had gotten this big job. I didn't go to college, but somehow I like snaked my way into the music industry and ended up kind of moving my way up on sheer determination. You know, wasn't in the program, but wasn't actively using. And you know, that was sort of my replacement for a number of years. And like they say in the program, it gets worse, never better. And that was just so true for me, because what happened was, right when I hit my early 30s, when my life was really big and when I had a lot more to lose than when I was in my 20s, like it came back, and it came back with a vengeance. And like, the truth is, it was really never gone. And, you know, it was like all the same stuff. I started blacking out again. And, you know, I became this really like kind of violent drunk. And so, again, I'll just kind of like fast forward through that, but it was a really, really dark time. But this time, like the circumstances were, you know, I had this big career and I would find myself blacked out in different parts of the world, because at that point I was traveling and going on tour. And, you know, my boss ended up having to come to me and say like, I need you to get help. And it's interesting that it's never the people that you think it's going to be. And I think it made it all the more humiliating for me. And my last night of drinking, I had destroyed my apartment. You know, it was one of those mornings I woke up and I kind of said like, well, what to my partner at the time, I said like, what did I do? Like, was it that bad? And, you know, just sort of the gaslighting that we do where we, you know, kind of try to wiggle our way out of something. But for some strange reason, it was like they say in this program too, is like by inches and seconds, right? I decided to go to a meeting that morning just to get the heat off me. I was hungover. Like, obviously I was emotional, and I went to a women's meeting and it was fine, you know, and I walked out. And then the next day I just said, I'll go again. I'll go to another one just until people stop being mad at me. And I did. And I met my sponsor there, Barbara B, and she didn't let me leave the room until we got each other's numbers. And I sort of knew at that moment that it was like time to do the work. Like, cause I'd been in this program before and I knew that it could work for me, but I just didn't know if I wanted that life for myself. Like, I never thought I deserved a life of calm and peace and serenity. And, you know, like, I always wonder, like, I didn't have hobbies. I didn't understand how people got hobbies. Like, I didn't, like, how did they know they wanted to do them? Just, that was like such an example of just the type of person I was at that time, where my world was really small. I had no interests, you know? And that was never something I expected to get when I came here. Like, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something they tell you when you walk in the door, but, you know, I was like dead inside, and I didn't even know it, which was the saddest part. And so, you know, I started coming and I strung together a few days and then a few months, and I kept telling myself that if I wanted to go back out, if every day didn't keep getting better, which I know is like a very idealistic way of looking at sobriety, but if every day didn't keep getting better, then I could go back whenever I wanted. And for some reason, my higher power decided that like every day did keep getting better for whatever reason. You know, even some days it was just the fact that I didn't wake up not knowing what I said or did the night before. I didn't wake up with that horrible sinking feeling in my stomach, you know, not knowing who I took home or what I did. And, you know, like it just started to get peaceful. And there's another line. And I think it's in the Daily Reflections that says happiness comes quietly. And I remember reading that line and being like, I could, and it was recently that I read it. And I had always thrived in like the chaos of using and drinking, right? And nothing ever good seemed to come quietly. But, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about my life today. It is, you know, that person that stuck with me through that period of time where I had to go back to several rehabs and, you know, my job and everybody knew, you know, that person is my husband today. And that's never something I thought I wanted. Like, I thought that stuff was for lame people. And, you know, because I kind of always had to be the cool girl who like didn't need anyone. And, you know, today I have this like really calm household, and my husband is not an alcoholic, but he's a huge fan of you guys and what, you know, what this program has done for me. He's been with me through, you know, 3 years of being drunk and now almost 3 years of being sober. And I have a mortgage, which is freaking weird. I have like, I waved to my neighbors, you know, and this was somebody that like wasn't even trusted around my mom's purse for a long period of time. And so, you know, like I will say that if you're new, like don't try to figure out why this works or how it works. It just works. And I have this life that I never knew I always wanted. Like I would never have chosen this life for myself. Like never in a million years, you know, I never thought I wanted like the peace and serenity and routine and peace that comes with like sobriety and calm. And, you know, I love this group. And the last thing I'll say is like, I love this group because even though the whole world just sort of like went up in flames this year, the majority of the Pacific group stayed intact. And I went back to Ohio Street for the past two Sundays and like, it's all the same familiar faces, you know, it's Dave and it's Barbara and it's, you know, Stuart like growling at somebody because they like closed the door when they shouldn't have. And like, those are my people, you know, and that is my home. And it's just so comforting to know that like, no matter what happens, this group is here. And so I just want to thank you again for listening. And if you're new, I hope you heard something tonight. And I love you all. And I can't wait to see you in person. Thank you.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Brian G.
Hi, Brian Griggs, alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for inviting me to do the Zoom meeting. Thank you, Danny, for your share. I'm glad you went first. you know, I'm really excited to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I didn't always feel that way. You know, growing up, I always felt different. I always felt weird because I was different and I was weird. And, you know, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. And yet, you know, I would hang out with all the different crowds trying to find out, you know, what they wanted from me. Because I never really ever stood up for myself. And what that ends up looking like is I'm a chameleon. You know, I'll hang out with a certain group and then I'll feel like, you know, they don't like me. So I'll go to another group. And so I did all the things. I was an honor student. I was an athlete. You know, all those things. But I still felt like I was alone. And the thing that I understand today is I have a couple traits that I don't know if anybody can identify, but I have a talent that I can look at somebody and know exactly what they're thinking. And then before facial recognition even happened, I realized that, you know, I was the one that kind of discovered facial recognition because I could look at your face and know how you were feeling. And, you know, that was before I took a drink. And so I've always based my life on what you think about me because you're thinking about me. And then I would base your reaction to me on how you looked. And for the most part, I was wrong. But to me, I was right. And it was, you know, it's living that way is really tough. You know, so there was a party for Mary Santos when I was about 12 or 13. And Mary, Mary Santos. And I was thinking, man, I got to go to this party because maybe I'll meet Mary Santos. And then my friends were like, hey, come on, we're going to go underneath the overpass and we're going to, you know, drink some, you know, alcohol. Somebody got some alcohol. And I was like, okay, cool. Now, I wasn't going because I wanted to drink alcohol. I was going because somebody asked me. You know, I just wanted to feel a part of. And so what I did was, you know, I took a couple pulls on that and, you know, it went down, it burned, it tasted nasty. And I didn't, you know, there wasn't a magic where I was just like, I just got to start drinking every day. But what I did get was I got a sense of ease and comfort that, you know what, Mary's party is really not that big of a deal. Matter of fact, Mary isn't that big of a deal, you know. And that would set the tone for me for weekends and weekends and weekends while I was in school. You know, one of the things that they talk about at the spiritual program, well, when I was younger, you know, I've had a lot of experience with death. I have my cousin's mom and dad were murdered. Then about the time that I started drinking, my best friend's brother, we watched him walk through cancer, you know, so me and God were not doing well. And I say that cause I'll come back to that later. But so, you know, my drinking was really just to try to be a part of. Apparently when I'm drinking, I like to moon people, moon my grandmother. Well, she wasn't too happy about that. I've jumped out of cars based on a theory that I thought was to be true, and it wasn't. You know, I've gone to work. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, King Alcohol brought some of his friends with him sometimes, and I've gone to work high, you know. And I'm a great worker when I'm high. I'm a great worker. And then I get to come down afterwards when I'm drinking. You know, but what happened for me is my life just started to just unravel. I've been in a few marriages. So if you need some marriage tips, you can chat me in the chat later on. And the thing was, is because I'm always looking for the love of my life. But until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and also I'm also in another program, Al-Anon, till I realized that I don't have to look for the love of my life. I need to love the life that I have. You know, it's kind of hard to do that when I'm drinking and using and doing all that. So anyhow, fast forward. I experienced a schoolyard shooting. One of the first, you know, I heard some bangs. I started running towards the playground, and I got to hold four kids as they died. And so I got to use that as a great excuse for, you know, leave me alone. Shortly after that, made the decision to be homeless. So Danny, I, you know, can relate to living in my car. But that was my decision. And on March 1st, 1994, I was done. So I called my sister, who was sober before me. She came, picked me up. She took me to this meeting. And if you're new and you come to the meeting and you're like, yeah, this isn't it. That's exactly how I felt. This isn't it. First of all I needed was a job and a place to stay, and I would be fine. But you were telling me that I have to have this program. You were telling me the steps. You read the same stuff every single meeting. I mean, how long does it take to comprehend that stuff? I mean, you should read it once and it's done. And then it says God as you understand him. So I ended up being in the Pacific Group, which I'm a proud member of. I started going to the yard. I started doing all those things, you know, and life started getting good. Because of my sponsor direction, I became a bodyguard for an actress, and I traveled around the world. But I'd be like in Monte Carlo trying to figure out what the time difference was, because if I missed my call from my sponsor, he would be so pissed, you know. And that to me, when I look back, that's when I realized, you know what, I put sobriety first, you know, because all that other stuff, I've had that, all the material stuff. But what was dying was what was inside of me, you know. So eventually I started, you know, working the steps. At 21 years sobriety, you know, I had a suicide attempt. And I don't say that, you know, to make you feel sorry for me. I say that because there's a time in my sobriety always that the first thing that goes is my program. You know, and if I don't have my sponsor that I'm accountable to and that I'm consistent with, then I feel like I'm doing everything alone. And so after that point, I learned, you know, Tim, my sponsor, Tim knows everything about me. Matter of fact, I called him last night and it was like 11 o'clock in Durango. And, you know, because not because, you know, I didn't know what to do, It's because sometimes for me, the most obvious isn't the most obvious. You know, my sponsor, it talks about a disease of perception. And my sponsor sees it differently than I do. Everything I see is right here. You know, my sponsor sees it out here. So that's why I run everything I can by Tim. And I have friends that I run stuff by first before I go to Tim. And then they always say, go to Tim. However, Tim knows that I do go to him. But, you know, one of the things that happened for me was when my dad passed away, I'd been visiting him every weekend, driving up north and, you know, all these things. And, you know, when he died, I used to call him every day. And I'm the one, I get perplexed by simple things. Like, I didn't know who I was going to call anymore. But thank God I got a sponsor, you know, and he told me, why don't you call your mom? You know, so, oh, I didn't even think about that, you know. But so if you're new, you know what, be accountable and consistent. Get a sponsor. You know, the steps are put to make our lives easier, but they're tools and you don't know how to use them. So that's why you have a sponsor. And what I love about this program, especially if you're new, what I love about this program is my sponsor gives me his experience, not his theories, you know, not what he read somewhere, but his actual experience. And that's what we do for each other. And no matter what you go through, I lost my brother a month ago. I lost, you know, four other family members this year, and I never walked through it alone, ever. And whatever you go through, you never have to go through it alone. All these people on the screen will be willing to be there for you. And where else does that happen? You know, again, thank you, Mary, for inviting me, and thank you all, and enjoy another day of sobriety.
Thank you, Brian. Our main speaker tonight is Tim H.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Hyland, and I'm an alcoholic. I've had the beautiful, wonderful gift of sobriety since April the 12th of 1990, and I'm so grateful for that and so blessed to be here tonight with you all. Appreciate it. My home group is the Lampton Group in Louisville, Kentucky, and my home. My sponsor is a wonderful little man named Don M. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I really think someday, at least is my thought, that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous will be looked on as one of the greatest love stories of all time. And after 31 years into this, I don't think I would have told you that initially, but 31 years looking at what's happened since I've been a member of this unbelievable organization, you know, it's the less broken helping the more broken at any given time. And I'm so happy to be here. And I do want to thank Mary, for inviting me, and Dave for staying on me, making sure I got here on time. And, you know, the Pacific Group has been, I have a real affinity for the Pacific Group as it turned out. I know, Clancy was one of the very first tapes I ever listened to, and that really made me for the first time identify, with alcoholism. And at 5 years sober, I was having just a bit of a problem with my life. And I met a wonderful man named Keith Carpenter. And Keith is gone also. But Keith drugged me out to the desert. He was a member of the Pacific Group, and he drugged me out to the desert, introduced me to a lot of people in California and AA. And that was going to be a really important thing for me as my sobriety went on. And I also want to mention my very good friend, Sharon C., who I just love and been able to just develop an incredible friendship over the years. You know, I'll just jump right to it. You know, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family here in Louisville, and it wasn't if you were going to drink, it was when and how good were you going to do it, right? And there wasn't any doubt. It was part of my culture. It was part of my life. And, you know, and the deal was at 15 years old, I went at it just like everybody in my family I had watched. And the thing I would tell you about my early drinking especially is that without a doubt, alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, I was really one of those awkward, you know, goofy, fighting pimples, glasses wearing kids that just was really having a difficult time negotiating the world of being a teenager. But when I got a hold of that alcohol, it made everything okay. And actually, the truth was, it was going to be my solution for a very difficult teen life for many, many years. And then, you know, it worked so well as a teenager, I just doubled down as I went into my adulthood and took off with it. And I remember thinking, thank God that God made this stuff, because he made it for guys like me. Something, it works for me in some way. I don't care if it works for other people, but it works for me just fine. Thank you. You know, one of the things I'll share with you is that in the state of Kentucky, where I grew up, if you can shoot a basketball through a hoop, that's a big deal here, right? And that's all I ever wanted to be. As a kid, you know, I wanted to grow up and be a good basketball player and get a scholarship to a Division I college. And that happened. You know, I was really good at it. I was an all-city player, an all-state player. Name was in the paper a lot. Picture was in the paper a lot. And I got that scholarship to Division I college when I graduated from high school, St. Louis University. In fact, we played UCLA when I was a sophomore out there. And it wasn't very nice. They killed us back in those days. That's when a little guy named Lou Alcindor was playing for the UCLA Bruins. But anyway, my dream came true, you know, and I left Louisville and went to St. Louis at 18 years old. And alcoholism kind of jumped in my life so quick that by the first game of my sophomore year, I showed up to that game so drunk that the other players had to hide me on the end of the bench so they wouldn't throw me out of school. So this is like going to watch your favorite Division I team on the end of the bench. One of the kids is drunk. And what happened to me that day was going to be a pattern that would happen over and over for about 27 years. I was walking down the street. A guy said, "Hey, you want to get a drink?" And I said, "Well, yeah." I always said, "Yeah," because I had a mind that would always go something like, "Okay, I'll come and have a couple beers, go home, get a nap, get up, get a shower, go to the game, and I'll probably be the hero." You know, that's what my mind would do. And at 18 years old, I didn't know anything about a physical allergy or mental obsession. And I didn't know anything about phenomenon of craving, I promise you. And if you'd have told me at 18 years old that the first drink was my problem, I would have told you you were nuts. And the truth was, for the next 27 years, I tried to find out where the cutoff point was, where a guy could cut it off where the consequences didn't come. And I don't know about you all, but I never found the cutoff spot. I got here to AA and you guys said, "Hey, guess what? It is the first drink." And I remember reading the doctor's opinion and thinking, "Oh my God, this explains a lot." You know, when I read about the allergy and understood that it did something different in my body than it did for normal people. But anyway, from that point forward, the reason that was important is that from that point forward, alcohol and alcoholism would dictate on a daily basis what I did, who I did it with, and especially where I ended up on any given day, right? Alcohol was driving the bus. You know, I actually played basketball through my junior year. I got hurt. I couldn't play my senior year. And the sad part about it is I didn't care. The most important thing in my life, the thing I had spent my whole life trying to achieve, I didn't care anymore. Because once alcohol became part of my life, nothing was important. You know, and once it went by the basketball, as I looked back, it was going to be real simple to go by my marriage, to go by my job. You know, it started driving the bus when I was 18 years old. And of course, I didn't understand it was driving the bus at the time. I guess we get so smart looking back. You know, my friend Bob says, you know, we live life forward, but we understand it backwards. But anyway, the basketball came to an end, and came to my senior year and I had to graduate. And I say it that way because I didn't have anywhere else to go. I kind of wanted to stay there and keep the party going if I could, but they said, "No, you got to leave." Now, in 1970, when I graduated, there were two ways you could get out of the draft, because they also had a thing called the draft lottery where they drew your birthday out of a hat to see when you were going. I was number 6 out of 365. I was going, right? I made the top 10. And if you're a vet, I just want to say this is that, you know, I wasn't going to run to Canada. You know, I wasn't brought up that way. But the bottom line was it certainly wasn't high on my priority list either. Now, there were two ways you could get out of the draft back in 1970. You could get married. And I thought, "Oh, man, that's awful drastic." Or you could go to grad school. well, we're going to get married. So I decided I got to go to grad school. That's my only choice if I'm going to stay out of the war. And I came up with the plan for my life. And I say it this way because some of you are going to think I'm really out there. There's a few of you are going to be right with me on this, but I was a political science major back in the days. A lot of it's in the 60s. We're going to change the world, and we majored in political science. And the plan I came up with was this. I'm going to take the test to get into law school. I'm going to pass that test. I'll get into law school. I'll graduate from law school. Then someday I'll run for Congress and someday President of the United States. Now, as crazy as that sounds, it's a short trip for me from street drunk to President of the United States. You know, I can get there. And I went and took the test. And as you might guess, I got a terrible score on the LSAT and the law school turned me down. Now, as meager as it may sound to you now, my life was on the line as far as I could tell. And I thought, Tim, you better come up with a new plan. And so it hits me. Tim, stop drinking, buddy. Stop drinking and study for that test because you got the brains to get into law school. For the next 5 weeks, I don't drink a drop. You know, it was awful. I had to get over the shakes. It was during the springtime. People were out partying. I found this real smart egghead guy down the hall, and he tutored me every day on how to take this law test. 5 weeks, dry in a bone, I gave it the best that God had in me. Came down to the day before the second test. For some reason, I guess the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink. For some reason, I decided it would be a good idea, since I was ready, to go out and get a couple beers so I could relax, come back, get a good night's sleep, get up, take the test, pass the test, get into law school, Congress, President of the United States. You know, same plan, one little upfront change there. I left for Friday afternoon for those two beers. I didn't get back to that campus to the following Tuesday. Found out later on, I rode around St. Louis on a city bus about a day and a half of what I know today is called a blackout. And honest to God, I did not know what a blackout was until I got to AA. I didn't know. I used to start somewhere, end up somewhere else with a big old chunk of time gone. And if that's happening in your life right now, it's not right. It took me a long time to understand that that was not normal. Anyway, I think God started to have fun with me about this time, because about 2 a.m, I knew I was drunk. I wasn't going to take the test, but I went back to the dormitory and I found the real smart guy who tutored me, and I paid him $25 to go take that test for me. And I'm not proud of that, but that's where I was. And in those days, it was way too easy to do that. So he goes and takes the test for me. I stayed drunk for 3 days. I even forgot he took the test. About 3 weeks later, we got the results of the test the guy took in my name. The guy gets the highest score in the history of the law school. I remember opening this envelope going, "You idiot, look what you've done to me now, man." He doubled the score I had gotten on the first one. Of course, and I knew I was in trouble, so I thought I better get to them before they get to me, and I made an appointment to go see the dean of the law school. Now, here I am, 23 years old, Mr. Allstate, Mr. Wonderful. 4 short years after getting there in all my glory, standing in front of the dean of the law school, lying through my teeth, saying, "Dean, you're probably wondering about the difference in them two scores. Hey, listen, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. I let some other dude take it." You know, as if I didn't know. And I knew that he knew I was lying. But, you know, I'd been there many, many times. But what I wanted to share is, I walked out of that room, it went through my head very clearly. "Tim, you know the problem, man. It's the booze. The booze took the basketball out of your life, and the booze took your chance to go to law school, because you know you should be doing both of those things." For that moment, anyway, it was that clear. It just didn't last very long. You know, I left that office. There were two guys that I know. They said, "Hey, you want to get a drink?" I said, "Yeah, you bet. I need a drink." That was 1970. It was going to be 20 years until I showed up into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you this. In those 4 short years, alcohol and alcoholism took from me the very things I would fight you over today. Took my dignity. Took my integrity. Took my confidence and trust in myself. It took my sense of purpose. You know, I say that because sometimes we know that it takes our money, it takes our relationships, it takes our job, but it also takes this stuff down deep down inside us that I know myself as a human being I really, really cherish. And the reason I know that, over the last 31 years, you guys have helped restore those things back into my life. And I really thank you for that, and I'm appreciative of that. Came back to Louisville, told, of course, everybody in Louisville that I just didn't want to be a lawyer. I missed them, and I just wanted to come home and be with them. I went and took the draft physical, flunked the draft physical on a congenital birth defect. I thought, man, that would have saved me a whole lot of trouble there. And I got into teaching and coaching. I don't have time tonight to get into all of that, but I'll just tell you this. Teaching and coaching at the high school level is not a good place for a drunk. When you have to show up every morning hungover and face a whole classroom full of 18-year-old boys, it wasn't a pleasant experience most days. And during that time I did that, was not proud of that, you know, showing up to basketball games drunk, showing up to PTA meetings, parent-teachers conferences under the influence, stuff that, you know, I can't imagine today if I walked into parent-teachers conference and one of my kids or grandkids and I smelled booze on the teacher. But that's where I was. You know, let me share with you, when I came back from St. Louis College after that law school debacle, I had met my high school girlfriend when we were seniors in high school. And we dated for about 6 months, and then I took off to St. Louis. She stayed in Louisville. And then for the next 4 years, it was one of those on and off, love the one you're with type of relationships, right? So when I came back to Louisville, I hadn't seen her in months. You know, we've been broken up for a long time. But I'm living with mom and dad, and I'm out one night, and I run into my old girlfriend. And oh, my God, she looked good. She looked great. And she was driving this little yellow sports car. I stopped and talked with her. She told me about this great job she had. She told me about this great apartment she was living in. I remember thinking, I'm falling in love here. I know I'm falling in love. That was August of 1970. We got married in November of 1970. Didn't want to rush it. And but anyway, we got married in November of 1970. We got divorced in 1983, but remarried in 1985. Got divorced again in 1987, but remarried in 1990. That's over. And then we got divorced again in 1995. You know, the thing that amazes me in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I tell people in my office this, they just go, what? You share this in AA and everybody goes, oh, okay, we got it. We got it. Yeah. What I can tell you tonight, what is that all about? Well, I can tell you now what it's all about. It's about alcohol, alcoholism, and everything that goes with it. I love him. I hate him. I hate him. I love him. He's good. He's bad. He's bad. He's good. If you don't know, there's a thing called alcoholism in the middle of any relationship, pretty much an impossible deal. And that's why, you all, I have a big place in my heart for Al-Anon, because if there ever was a family disease, this is it, right? Everybody around us gets pretty sick. Also had three beautiful children born in that marriage. And how about as a father having your oldest son born on Christmas morning? 1971, 9 a.m., I was supposed to be in the delivery room for that beautiful, wonderful gift from God. And I was in the hospital, but I was in the men's room with my head in a toilet bowl, spitting up whiskey, and all I could think about is I got to get out of here and get a drink. I missed the gift that morning, and I have to tell you, well, not a Christmas goes by that I don't think about that. Because my oldest son has been one of the hardest amends I've had to make. You know, it's been a tough journey with him. Because he was the one that was first, and he was the one that I abused and ignored the most. And I'll just share this with you again. I don't have time to go into it, but one of the things I had to accept in my early sobriety was that it was going to be a slow process. An old guy told me, Tim, you'll get credibility back in your life one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing. That didn't even sound good to me now, but I need to tell you, that's exactly what happened. You know, 8 years into this, he called me one day and things had changed, and I could tell they changed. And he knew his dad was different. He knew I actually listened to him when I talked, when he talked, and he knew that I was helping a lot of men in AA. And one day at a time, my credibility got better with him. And today, we're good friends. He has three beautiful daughters who are my granddaughters. He loves every minute, every second that they're with me. You know, I left the teaching and coaching thing in the 70s because, like most drunks, I guess I had to do my own thing, right? Started my own business, and I started my insurance business in 1980. Let me give you a quick update of the 80s. Was not a good decade. already told you I got divorced in 83, remarried in 85, divorced in 87, and remarried in 90. I was engaged to two other women in between time. I was in the asylum two different times. I was in five car accidents. I had 12 different business partners. I got shot at. I got stabbed with a beer bottle, and I lost $250,000. And I was thinking, this is going okay. This is going okay. You know, I can, I just need to make a couple adjustments. From 1982 to 1985, I went through five psychiatrists. That was simple. I kept them until they started talking about alcohol. He started talking about alcohol, fired them, got me a new guy.